reinforced its efforts to try to maintain division among the Palestinian leadership and play divide and rule policies between the PA and Hamas.
What would you like to see happen, Tariq, right now? It looks like Israel is on the verge of a ground invasion of Gaza. What do you think needs to happen?
Well, the most immediate need right now is for a de-escalation. World leaders, and specifically the U.S. and the Biden administration, need to understand that this is not a retaliation by Israel towards Hamas. What we are seeing now is the effort by Israel to pursue an ethnic cleansing campaign and to continue the Nakba, which began in 1948 and which has been ongoing since in fits and starts here and there. What we're seeing is a massive rupture in the daily ethnic cleansing that Israeli authorities are implementing against the Palestinians in the West Bank and in East Jerusalem, as well as in the Gaza Strip. And now we're seeing that that rupture take the ethnic cleansing campaign from a daily, continual basis into a significantly more focused attempt at getting rid of millions of Palestinians. We need to de-escalate, and we need to ensure that humanitarian aid comes into the Gaza Strip, because this is impacting Gaza's civilian population. This is a starting step. The next step needs to be an acknowledgement that Israel is an apartheid regime that is maintaining a system of domination against millions of Palestinians. It's the only sovereign power in the land of historic Palestine, and it allows rights only to Israeli Jewish citizens, not to Palestinians. What happened on October 7th is a testament to the fact that that reality cannot go on, and that overturns the assumption that the U.S. administration, as well as regional powers, have always had, which is that Israel can continue to act with impunity without any cost to its citizens. And I believe we cannot go back to that paradigm anymore.
Tariq Bokhony, I want to thank you very much for being with us, Palestinian analyst and writer, president of the board of Al-Shabaka, the Palestinian Policy Network, author of the book Hamas Contained, The Rise and Pacification of Palestinian Resistance. We will link to your piece in the New York Review, headline Gaza Without Pretenses. For years, Israel and Hamas maintained an unstable equilibrium that kept the Gaza Strip contained, but it was always likely to be temporary. When we come back, we continue our conversation with the legendary Israeli journalist Amira Haas, who's reported from the occupied territories for over three decades. Back in 20 seconds.
فلسطين نفديكي بعيننا فلسطين انت الروح ونن العين مثل ارضك نلقى وين هلا والله ويا هلا.
Palestine is the Soul by Mohammed Asaf. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. We spend the rest of the hour with legendary Israeli journalist Amira Haas, who's reported from the occupied West Bank and Gaza for over 30 years. She's the Haaretz correspondent for the occupied Palestinian territories, usually based in Ramallah. Her latest piece is headlined with "No Water or Electricity from Israel, Gazans Risk Dehydration and Disease." Today, we bring you part two of our conversation. On Thursday, Democracy Now!'s Nermeen Sheikh and I spoke to her after she attended Wednesday's historic protest in Washington, D.C., led by American Jewish groups calling for an immediate ceasefire. We asked her to describe the scene.
Look, it was people, it was an expression of common grief and shock of people, of Jews, whose main two slogans were "not in our name" and "ceasefire immediately." And for me, it was very important to be there. So I was there as a person, as an individual, as a Jew, not as a journalist. There were quite a few Israelis that I know that live or study these days in the States. And it was also, you know, like we all need some kind of this kind of support. which, by the way, Palestinians are not allowed to hold. Jews are allowed to hold demonstrations. I understand that all over Europe there are places where Palestinians are not allowed to hold demonstrations in solidarity with their slain people in Palestine. So here again, we are privileged, the Jews, that we can do things that Palestinians are not allowed to. Though I know that here there were some in the States, there were some demonstrations of Palestinians. But Palestinians are being silenced, as I hear. They are sensitivity, that their sense of grief is not being respected. They are called as supporters of terror, whatever. And I was in Boston just before, and I could tell that even the word Palestinian is not allowed to be used in all kind of official statements. I can very much identify with the feeling of being ostracized by the whole world as a Jew, of being not listened to, or this feeling, this indifference that the world shows to Palestinians' plight, Palestinians' ordeal. Is so shocking, and I, as a Jew, I say, and as a child of survivors, and the grandchild of Jews who were murdered by Nazi Germany, I can my identification and sense of identification and anger and despair, I must say, despair grow larger by the day, by the minute.
Well, Amira, you wrote in one of your recent Haaretz pieces precisely from the position of someone who is the daughter, the child of Holocaust survivors, in a piece headlined Germany, You Have Long Since Betrayed Your Responsibility. In the piece, you write about your father, who would tell you as far back as 1992, he himself a Holocaust survivor. When you returned from Gaza, he would say, quote, true, this isn't a genocide like what we went through, but for us, it ended after 5 or 6 years. For the Palestinians, the suffering has gone on and on for decades. So if you could, say a little bit more about your father's position and the fact that this isn't also, in a sense, understandably, the position of most people who are survivors, or the children of survivors of the Holocaust. If you could explain a little.
Look, I mean, in 92, yes, it was. We could say that it is not genocide. I want to say, I mean, I don't, as I explain over and over again, I prefer not to talk now, not to dwell into definitions, but to describe the situation. Of course, in 92, in comparison to today, it was like a benign occupation in comparison to today, to what's going on now. Look, I know I come from a leftist family, so it has been clear that if there is a lesson to the Nazi German industry of murder, which I think is more accurate to say than Holocaust, if there is a lesson that it shouldn't be the fate of any people in the world, not just the Jews. And another lesson that my father taught me, he warned about wars. He warned about that during wars, things always get worse and worse and without control. And that's why exactly why the Israeli right wing and the messianic religious settler right wing has been always pushing for wars and regional wars, because in order to achieve the grand plan of repeating and completing 1948, the Nakba. I say these things, and I don't believe that we are in this stage, and we are, and the world is silent and or idle, and it was idle during in so many phases in human history, it was idle. I want to say something else. At the beginning of 2000, during the Second Intifada, I was contacted by Howard Zinn, the great historian Howard Zinn, who very much in the vein of my father's warning about wars, he told me that he thinks of an initiative of people to start talking about war, to outlaw wars at all, you know, not just to say that these are certain crimes in a war. The war is a crime. That's why I also don't use the term war crime, because the war is a crime. But because wars unleash such barbarism out of human beings, all human beings, that our ability to return to decent normalcy is so limited. This is the background. This is my background, my parents' background. And we've tried, they tried, and I tried, and as both as an activist and as a journalist, to appeal to people and to the, you know, humanity of people and rationality of people, and because this will harm what's happening today. The Palestinians are the targets for sure, but eventually this will harm anybody in the region, and will harm Israeli Jews, and as it does Palestinians in Israel. I'm still talking, and I'm still hoping that it will stop immediately.
You came on Democracy Now! In February, and at that time, you wrote to us afterwards saying the danger of mass expulsion of Palestinians is nearer than ever since the Nakba. One cannot repeat enough times this message in order for it to remain a warning and not a prophecy. Can you explain exactly what you mean? Of course, it's now October. At this point, something like 3,800 Palestinians are dead, but the hundreds of thousands that have been displaced, and then the Israeli army telling the Palestinian population in Gaza that half of them must leave the northern part, the most populated part of the most densely populated place on earth, and move south.
Look, I must say that at that time when I wrote in February, I thought more about the West Bank. But we see that they are working now in these two fronts that are inseparable, because it's the Palestinian people, and both under Israeli occupation, even though the West Bank, the Gaza Strip, is in a different constellation. But just as Dr. Mustafa said, they want to pressure Egypt to open and to allow and to let Palestinians go, because otherwise people will say, oh, it's also the fault of Egypt. Why don't they let all the people flee to Egypt? There are calls in Israel to let Palestinians build there in Sinai, to build a new town and things like that. But in the West Bank also, the danger of mass expulsion. And that's why, again, I repeat what Dr. Mustafa said, that's why the King Abdullah is so alarmed, because he senses that if Palestinians are being pushed, they will be pushed towards Jordan. There is a longer standing Israeli claim that the real Palestine is Jordan, because the majority of people in Jordan are Palestinians. So the danger now exists, and again, I repeat, at wars, the right wing wants wars in order exactly to accomplish these plans that are kind of subdued during normal times. And our normalcy is never normal.
Well, Amira, I want to, in fact, quote to you again from another piece that you wrote just days after the Hamas assault in Israel. You wrote a piece headlined, "Arriving Again at the Cycle of Vengeance." In this you write, "As in every Israeli war against the Gaza Strip that Hamas has an interest in, especially given the murder of civilians, one should ask, does this organization have a realistic plan of action and a realistic political goal, or did it mainly want to rehabilitate its own position in the eyes of Gaza residents? Was its military operation accompanied this time by a logistical plan to assist and rescue Gazan civilians under attack?" So if you could respond to some of those rhetorical questions that you asked, and what is going on with the hostages? I mean, now Israel has said they've increased the number. There are 203 hostages. Israel Israeli hostages who are being held in Gaza. What is their position, and what do we know of what the Israeli state is doing to negotiate or force their release? Yeah. Presumably, they're also being affected by this constant bombardment.
Exactly. I have no idea how many people, how many of the hostages, some of them I know their relatives. I know one of them who is 85 years old and a very brave journalist who in Oded Lifshitz, his name, I just realized it. He's 85. He was in the 70s. He exposed the expulsion of Bedouins in the northern of Sinai. He exposed it in a series of articles. I know some people that are relatives of, as I said, of friends of mine. And we don't know what's happening, you know, like we don't, I mean, if they are under, they are in the same conditions like every Palestinian now in Gaza. If they are alive, they are without water and electricity. If they are wounded, there is no way to really treat them. They are separated. If they are separated, how they are held by, some are held by Islamic Jihad, some are held by Hamas. Where do they hold them? Did they flee from the south to the, to, from the north to the south? We don't have answers to all these questions. And I don't know how many answers the Israeli army has. You know, at this time while we are talking, Israel is also arresting and has arrested and arresting more Palestinian workers from Gaza who were in Israel during just when everything started. At first, they were allowed to go into Palestinian cities in the West Bank, but now they are arresting them. They and I allow myself to suspect that they also want to play with this card when they are negotiating about the release of the Israeli. Prisoners people who were abducted. Look, Hamas proved to be very resourceful when it comes to the military operation. They knew how to neutralize Israeli surveillance facilities, how to neutralize the shooting, automatic shooting. They knew where the military bases were, etc. So they were very resourceful in a way that I could have said impressive, if not that for the atrocities that were committed later. And the atrocities were committed. And I know that it's not the time to tell Palestinians to pay attention to this, because Israel's revenge is 100 times more bloodier. But still, there were atrocities. So I feel there is a tremendous contradiction between the planning of the immediate military operation and what comes aftermath, what is the aftermath. Because, for example, the civilian phase in the West, in Gaza, if they knew that they have such an operation and they knew that Israel will retaliate ferociously, then why, for example, they did not even, I don't know, take care that people have water. I don't know. I mean, if they can arrange to have so many weapons, they must have also prepared for assisting the civilian population, their civilian population. But I see that this, from what I can tell from far, I don't see that this has happened. I don't think that Hamas can be erased. It can flourish outside of Gaza, but I don't understand its political plan right now. Do they want to liberate all of Palestine? So it doesn't matter if it will take 50 years, 80 years, and at the cost of lives of Palestinians and Israelis, that I don't know who will return to the country. Who will live in this destroyed country if this is the plan? If the plan is political, immediate political, is it worth to ask, demand the release of present Palestinian prisoners in Israeli prisons, and the cost is so much? I think I know some prisoners in jail now. I don't think they'll be happy to be released thanks to the death of thousands or tens of thousands of Palestinians. So right now, I see very militarily a very apt organization that indeed gave Israel a very distinctive blow. But I don't see that there is a political viable position that comes with it. That's me now. I don't know. I mean, we are waiting because just war, just bloodshed. Where will it lead us to? Where will it lead the Palestinians to? Now it's very difficult for people to criticize Hamas. There is a lot of support, but is it a political? Does it have a political, logical, human perspective? I don't see it.
And the response to the repeated assertions on television, I want to ask you also, because it's how Americans understand what's happening, is through the corporate media. I mean, their younger population doesn't watch television, older population does. If you watch CNN, starting, for example, yesterday, but this was a repetition before, it's one Israeli Defense Force representative after another. You even have Naftali Bennett, right, who's the former prime minister, who is now one of the army, saying, are you, to Sky News, you seriously asking me about Palestinian civilians? But starting yesterday, after the bombing of the hospital, however that turns out, whoever's responsible for that, throughout the day, through today, the lower third of CNN was U.S. sources, U.S. officials say Israel is not responsible. That goes larger than the hospital. Throughout the day, the discussion that it seems Netanyahu is quite victorious in this, whether it's a lie or whether it's true, a bigger point, Israel is not responsible. And so I wanted to ask you about that. This is at a time when over 3,500 Palestinians, of course, have been killed, dozens of other health facilities, actually, including that one, attacked just a few days before that. IDF did not say they didn't do, what this kind of coverage means, because, you know, Chomsky says the media is manufacturing consent for war in general. But it matters because the U.S. is the most powerful country on earth and the main weapons supplier to Israel.
Yeah. Look, what does it mean Israel is not responsible? Israel has engineered this since, since the early 90s, when the world pushed Israel and the Palestinians wanted this, to have a kind of a compromise. And this is following the Palestinian First Intifada, that have the very clear political message. We don't want our children, I heard so many activists say that, we don't want our children to live in the way we lived under occupation. So let's compromise and have a state, a Palestinian state, alongside Israel. And this was an accepted way out from the bloodshed and the crisis and the conflict. And the world supported it, or seemed. And Israel did everything possible to foil the possibility of establishing a Palestinian state alongside Israel. So it only increased and enhanced its colonialist drive since the beginning of Oslo. And Israel disconnected Gaza and treated it as a separate enclave with no connections to the people of the West Bank and the rest of Palestine and Israel, not since Hamas came to power, long before, in the early 90s. So what is not responsibility? No, not Israel's responsibility. It is Israeli policy that has created such a chain of reactions that We could tell it. We could say, we said it over and over again to Israelis, to diplomats, to foreign diplomats, to foreign countries. We warned over and over again. We knew and we wanted to prevent it from happening. So how can they say Israel is not responsible? And you know what? Every Palestinian who is killed today in Gaza is registered in the Israeli controlled population registry. Palestinians are not registered in a separate one. It's Israel which controls. If a person is not registered, he is there. If a newborn is not registered in the Israeli registry of population, then the newborn does not exist. Israel controls still today. Palestinian Authority is obliged to give every name of a newborn and every change of address to Israel for validation of this change. So what is not responsible? It's part of Israel. I mean, Israel controls the whole country, controls the people, decides how much water they have, what is the economy they are allowed to have. If they don't go to universities in the West Bank, Israel decides. Israel decides about every detail of these people. So what's happening now is not Israel's responsibility. This is exactly, this is how the majority don't, of mainstream media don't want to deal with it. They start to deal with this with conflict and the cruelty only when it reaches this unbearable top. But there is incremental cruelty and violence and evil and bureaucratic evil, bureaucratic violence that has been there for years, accumulating one layer after another, and it chokes everybody, every Palestinian. You know, Palestinians in Gaza, people who are under 30 years old have never seen a mountain in their lives. A mountain. They don't understand the concept of a spring of water coming out of a rock or a mountain. I know it because a young friend of mine, she had the chance to come to the West Bank because she has cancer. So her friends tell her, you are so lucky because you have cancer so you could leave the Gaza Strip. Her brothers are surprised when she tells them about the mountains that she saw in the West Bank. So you take from the people for so many years, you take every hope and every horizon, every joy you take out of them. And still I want to say, and I want to say that the more I hear about this Saturday, and I think that many details are, I mean, I verified about many details and the atrocities were there, but it taught me that people came, not the majority, a few, but it only tells me how the pressure that has built up, how monstrous it was to create these monstrous attacks in one day.
Amira Haas, longtime Israeli correspondent for Haaretz in the occupied Palestinian territories, usually based in Ramallah. She's author of Drinking the Sea at Gaza, Reporting from Ramallah, and wrote the foreword and afterword to her mother Hannah Levy Haas's Holocaust memoir, Diary of Bergen-Belsen. To see part one of our interview with Amira and also our interview yesterday with Dr. Mustafa Barghouti, visit democracynow.org. I'm speaking tonight in Charleston, West Virginia at the Grassroots Radio Conference, 7:30 p.m. at the Capitol Theater. Visit democracynow.org for details. Oh, and happy birthday to Robbie Caron. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
Dear listeners, as you may have heard, Meta, which owns Instagram and Facebook, is blocking Canadian access to all content created by news providers, including this radio station, in response to the Online Broadcasting Act. Access to local news and information matters to everyone, and while radio stations use their airwaves to keep you informed, we also use social media to share local news, events, and initiatives, and even content about our upcoming programming. We need you to write your MP and convey your concerns. Learn more and find a letter template for your MP on our website. Thank you for your support.
Donations to the War Amps have a lasting impact on amputees. Today, your support gives them the artificial limbs needed for everyday activities. This helps them prepare for tomorrow on their road to independence. To learn how your donation helps, visit waramps.ca.
Ha huagestig ri CGSF, nached poing aun FM, Crowley vo Burnaby, British Columbia.